fifth market specialist was able to tell me the absolute lowest rent they've ever rented in a particular neighborhood within a certain parameter. And that number was great. It was within $50 of what they were telling me. And even if I got the lowest number, that'd be a great return, terrific results. And then the other thing about having people applying and teed up and lined up to rent your properties right away, just because that marketplace is so huge and so many people, that just gives you a sense of confidence that you're going to have a very good cash flowing property without a great deal of risk that it's going to sit vacant for a month or 2 months and that sort of thing.
Welcome to the Creating Wealth Show with Jason Hartman. You're about to learn a new slant on investing, some exciting techniques, and fresh new approaches to the world's most historically proven asset class that will enable you to create more wealth and freedom than you ever thought possible. Jason is a genuine self-made multimillionaire who's actually been there and done it. He's a successful investor, lender, developer, and entrepreneur who's owned properties in 11 states, had hundreds of tenants, and been involved in thousands of real estate transactions. This program will help you follow in Jason's footsteps on the road to your financial independence day. You really can do it. And now, here's your host, Jason Hartman, with the complete solution for real estate investors.
Welcome, listeners from around the world. Thank you so much for joining me today. This is Jason Hartman coming to you live, I guess. Well, you know, what does that mean anymore? I am on location, and guess where I am? I say that debt is my favorite four-letter word, and I love to use debt as a powerful tool to accelerate wealth creation and reduce risk. And I happen to be standing in front of the Federal Reserve Bank of Kansas City. The address is 1 Memorial Drive. I'm looking at the sign right now, and I just toured the place where they indoctrinate people. It's called the Money Museum, and I toured it with one of our local market specialists who happens to be here with me, and that is Dave. You've heard him on the show before. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Good to see you, Jason.
It's good to have you, and thanks for just coming down here so fast. As I suggested, meet me at the Money Museum, and you know we're in the money business, so we wanted to talk about it. This is really interesting because we looked inside and we saw a wall that had $40 million on it in cash.
Yeah.
Wasn't that incredible?
It's crazy. It's crazy how much money's in there. And they gave us a free bag of money as we left.
Right? Yeah. Free bags of money on your way out. Now, of course, it's shredded money. And they would only let me take one. I tried to get a couple for friends, but they said that limit one per visitor. I'm going to grab a picture here that I took inside. And it had an amazing statistic on it. Let me find that. So listen to this, folks. As we're looking at the $40 million wall, did you know that on average, it takes only 24 minutes for the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to print 10 million new $100 bills in 24 minutes? So if you don't think money is going out of style, it definitely is. Really, we should say currency. It's not money, it's currency. There is a difference that I have discussed on the show many times before, meaning that money, of course, has intrinsic value. Currency is simply fiat paper. But, you can use that fiat paper. What I always say is align your interests with the most powerful forces on earth. One, we are standing in front of the Federal Reserve Bank, and the second most powerful force on earth is governments and central banks. Dave, what do you think about all this crazy money stuff and the way the Federal Reserve operates?
Yeah, it's a little bit insane when you're really trying to put your head around it. And I love your podcast and other folks that train on debt and inflation. And here's my two cents. Like yesterday was voting day, right? So I vote. I believe in your civic duty.
Now, if it was 2 cents yesterday, it's worth 1.8 cents today.
Yeah, even less. So by all means, do that. But at the end of the day, instead of sitting here and complaining about the way things are, right, with inflation and debt and the way currency is, why not do what you suggest and educate folks on, which is take advantage of that. Those forces are in play. You know, do whatever you can to fight against that. But at the end of the day, take advantage of that. And, you know, investing in passive real estate, taking advantage of debt, taking advantage of inflation, because that's happening. The central banks, the governments are heavily invested. They're going that route. So go with the flow. If you've ever jumped in the ocean and trying to fight the tide, it's really tough. Go with the tide. And that's my two cents.
Absolutely. You know, it reminds me of that old quote, because you used an ocean metaphor. 'Tis the set of the sails and not the gales that determine the direction of the ship.
Yep.
And that's sort of like this. You know, just align your interest. These forces are too powerful. Complain about them all you want, but you're never going to beat them. Give in, submit. be the subject, be the pawn, and just do the thing that they are doing. My investment strategy says just mirror the same strategy as governments and central banks. And that's the thing to do. You know, maybe one more comment on this, then let's talk about the real estate market and what's going on in the markets you cover.
Sure. Yeah, to underscore that, I mean, create your freedom and then do what you want with that, right? So take advantage of, like we talked about, the tide that's already there, the forces are in play. Create your freedom, then go do what you want with that. Create the lifestyle you want from that. Because, you know, I think about the difference between rich and wealthy. And to me, it's time, right? Rich people think about money, money, money. Wealthy people think about time. How can I create more time for myself and buy back some time? And for me, that's what passive investing is all about. Having a lifestyle like you are. You're traveling everywhere. For me, it's time with my family at the lake, but it's about time. And that's what passive income is. And so that's ultimately create your freedom. Go do what you want with it. And don't sit here and try and fight the forces that aren't going to move, you know?
Absolutely. You know, all the money in the world, it might buy you a little more time, but it won't buy you much, you know? And of course, we explore these ideas on my longevity and biohacking show. And I do think that is changing. And the people that will be able to take advantage of these amazing life extension opportunities that are coming our way are the people who have resources, who have money, because they'll be the first. Now, ultimately, it will democratize probably like every other technology, and everybody will be able to take advantage of that. But at first, it'll be the people with the money, because it'll be expensive for these various treatments and so forth, whether they be stem cells or whatever, you know. Just check out the Longevity and Biohacking Show for more on that. Hey, so a lot of the high-end real estate markets around the country are really showing some signs of sickness, aren't they? And let's kind of compare and contrast that to what's going on in your markets. And first, tell people, people ask me this once in a while, and the first time I ever heard the phrase, I had to look it up in Wikipedia. What is the Quad Cities?
Yeah, so Quad Cities is a cluster of four or five cities, quad meaning four. So really it's four cities, Davenport, Iowa, and Moline, Illinois being the two major ones. There's Bettendorf, Iowa, there's East Moline, but it's geographically halfway between Des Moines, Iowa, and Chicago. So draw a straight line in between, right on the Mississippi. The area is called Quad Cities, but there's really not a city called Quad Cities, just that region. So Davenport, Iowa, Moline, Illinois is one market that I've been in, you know, for years and years and years. And then we're in Kansas City, which is where I live. And that's the other market that I do turnkey out of.
Okay, so tell us, turnkey properties in these markets, and you've been working with us for many years as a local market specialist. So what's going on in those markets? Give us a pulse on them. I'm sure you're probably going to say, you know, inventory is tight, the market is booming, and that is definitely true in the linear markets. Sure. But as you read the major media, there are articles now about the market slowing. That's the cyclical, expensive markets with bad LTI or land to improvement ratios. Mm-hmm. In other words, high land values, low improvement values in comparison, improvement meaning the house or the apartment building that sits on the land. We want to invest in the linear markets with good LTI, land to improvement ratios. So give us a pulse on your market and talk to us about some of your properties that you actually have available right now. And by the way, folks, make sure you subscribe to my new really unique podcast called The Property Cast, where you can get properties, PDF files in your podcast feed. That's amazing. Everybody thought that was impossible, but I knew it was possible. So I pioneered the thing and we've got it there for you. Just go to iTunes or whatever podcast platform you use and type in Jason Hartman's Property Cast and subscribe to it. And please rate and review it. And you'll get performas of properties right in there, including the ones we're going to talk about today.
Yeah, so I'll do a little comparison, kind of compare and contrast, and then talk about, you know, some similar. Well, let's start with the similarities, right? To Jason's point, you know, a lot of Midwest markets. I mean, we're in Kansas City. We're right in the middle of the country, right? You can't get more Midwest than this. They are these linear markets. So, you know, what I would call steady eddy, you're never going to see wild fluctuations, right? So from a cash flow standpoint, they're great. So both markets fit that bill. Certainly things have become more competitive in Kansas City. It's a larger market. Some hedge funds are in town, and the market's heated up considerably, but we're still able to get solid returns. And we stay in, you know, nicer parts of town. So in Kansas City, you know, $150,000 turnkey, you're still, from a leverage standpoint, going to be on a cash-on-cash return of double digit. And Quad Cities is, the price points there are a little bit less. And the reason I work out of the Quad Cities is because we're able to deal with a lower price point and stay out of what I would call the urban core. So, for example, in Kansas City, which is my home, I love it. we don't source out of what I would call the urban core, because you can find an $80,000 house, $70,000 house in Kansas City. They're just in neighborhoods and properties that I wouldn't be comfortable sourcing. So in the Quad Cities, we don't have that type of an urban core, extremely low crime. So we can get a lower price point house. And it's also very high home ownership versus a rental market. So for example, it's about 70% homeowners versus 30% renters. So you get a very different type of tenant there. And so you can get a $90,000, $100,000 property that's going to get you a cash on cash finance return of, you know, 12, 13, 15%, even in today's competitive market. And we're able to get plenty of inventory in the Quad Cities because it's such a smaller market. It's kind of a little hidden gem. Whereas Kansas City, I mean, it's a bigger market, a lot of folks in town. So it's, you know, more competitive, I would say, than Quad Cities.
There's... Yeah. Okay. So in the Quad Cities, you're going to get better rent to value ratios then, right? Because, sure. And you're going to get a better quality neighborhood, a better quality tenant, because to get those RV ratios, the better ones, you don't have to go into the urban core and sacrifice, you know, you don't have to go down to like a C quality property. You can get a B, or can you get A's for that price in Quad City?
You cannot. Okay. So yeah, you're going to deal with an older built home. Our average rehab in the Quad Cities is 40,000. So a team that's been doing thousands of, you know, deals, you know, over 12 years, you know, rehab for them that's costing them 40,000-50,000 is a complete gut job, right? I mean, all CapEx, all mechanicals are being done. It would cost the average person 60,000. So
hang on. I don't want you to gloss over too much. So CapEx is capital improvements that are not like maintenance and repair type improvement. We talked about that before. Yeah. But also mechanicals. Explain what mechanicals mean. Maybe a few people don't know what that means.
Yeah, so the high maintenance item, that's a great, great point. Roofs, plumbing, HVAC.
The expensive stuff.
Yeah, the things.
The systems.
So when you're putting all new mechanicals in and you have deferred maintenance, like you put a brand new roof on, you're not going to have to replace that roof for 15, 20 years. So the expensive items are deferred for, you know, 10 years plus. So we're able to do a complete rehab on that type of property and sell it, you know, for $90,000 to have an A, what I would call an A rental property in the Quad Cities. You know, your numbers are going to go down. You can buy a rental up there for $150,000, $200,000, but your, you know, cash on cash return is going to be 6-7%. So it's not what we found is clients would rather have, as long as they have a complete new rehab, they would rather have the cash flow and the cash on cash return. And you're still going to get a steady over time. If you look historically, the Quad Cities, because of the economy, because you've got the Rock Island Arsenal, it's never going anywhere. You've got John Deere headquarters. You've got this market that's just marching on. You're still going to get, you know, a small appreciation over time, but it's really a cash flow play in the Quad Cities.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah. And cash flow is the way to go. Appreciation, you know, very unreliable. I have yet to meet anybody who can reliably predict market cycles. There are certainly clues, but at the end of the day, a large degree of it is a guess. You know, I think. Yeah, exactly. Even the folks here at the Federal Reserve, when we are standing in front of the Kansas City Federal Reserve Bank, boy, this is a nice building. You can tell there's a lot of money in here. I used the restroom here. It was a gorgeous restroom. A lot nicer than at any private establishment, I'll tell you that much. But hey, this is a private establishment, right? It's a private corporation. It's about as federal as Federal Express. So that's what they say. You know what I've noticed over the years, the past few years especially, and I don't know if it's because the properties being sourced are of lesser quality. In other words, maybe people like you, our local market specialists, have to dig deeper to find a deal because the market has been so hot. Mm-hmm. Well, here's what I was going to say. I'll start with what I'm going to say, and then we'll unpack it a little bit. I've noticed that when I make hard money loans now, and I'm a hard money lender, and I loan to a lot of our local market specialists. I don't think I've loaned to you yet.
No, you haven't.
All right. Well, if you need any money, let me know, and I'll loan it to you. And so I do these short-term loans that are like six-month loans to our local market specialist all the time. You know, it's a regular occurrence. And I started hard money lending maybe 8 years ago, you know, to do it in any real way. I've noticed that when I'm looking at the deal, the rehabs have gotten way more expensive. I mean, I used to finance deals where rehabs would be $7,000, $12,000, $15,000. Mm-hmm. And now when I'm looking at the sort of the stack of that deal, the way the capital stack has to be, mm-hmm. it's, you know, they'll buy the house for I don't know, 70 grand, and it's a $40,000 rehab. And I'm like, why are these rehabs so expensive? Have the construction costs risen that much? I know the materials and the labor are much more expensive than they were just a few years ago. So for those of you who say there's no inflation, you're out of your mind. But also, it's probably a combination. You got to dig deeper for a deal too, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it is a combination. So I'll, again, compare and contrast.
In other words, you got to buy the uglier house than you used to have to buy, right?
Yeah, something that's like, for example, Quad Cities, that is what we buy. We're buying something that, you know, is an REO. It's a, you know, it needs a lot of work, and we're putting $40,000 in because it's an older built home as well. In Kansas City, our average rehab is $20,000-$25,000. So it's a 1980s built. It's in a nicer part of town, so the rehabs don't take as much. A lot of the mechanicals are newer in those. So that's, I can only speak to really those two markets, but that's a part of it. If you're dealing with a, you know, what I would categorize as an A type of property, the rehabs take less versus a complete gut job on a C type of a property.
What do you think people should buy? And I know our investment counselors have a lot of opinions about this, and our clients have a lot of opinions about this. Some of our clients are the sort of bargain hunter type, and they really want a deal. They want to buy the C properties and just because they look cheap. And some people just want to buy A properties, nicer neighborhoods. What do you think is sort of the sweet spot? You can make money in anything, of course. You can make money buying F properties, you know, if you want to take a gun to collect the rent. Yeah. But what's the sort of the sweet spot for remote investors that don't live locally, that want to invest in areas that are better than the local area in which they live for better returns? What's the right property for them to buy? What would be your counsel there?
It's a great question. I get that question all the time. And the quick answer is, it depends. And I don't want to make that as a blow off, because it really does depend on your appetite and what your goals are. So I agree with you 1,000% that it's about cash flow, right? So that has to be first and foremost. But when I say appetite, I mean, for example, if you're
going to... Well, do you like steak or fish, you know?
Well, but also your appetite for risk and reward. So, for example, a C property, right? There's a margin of error there that if things go well and you're with the right team, if you're getting the right property management and the rehab's been done right and you can verify that, you're going to get cash flow. Some folks, though, don't have, I would say, more of a stomach for that kind of a risk reward. So it really comes down to the team you're working with and having the property management. I would say it this way. I mean, the property management is so important that I personally would rather buy a C property, even if it's in a borderline shady part of town, if it was rehabbed with the right team and the property management in place, versus a nice A property done with the wrong team. So the overall answer for me is it really depends on what like stage in your investing you are. Like there's some folks who are right at the end. They need to retire pretty quickly. That's a different strategy than say that somebody's in their 30s. Maybe it's they're going to go with more of a long-term potential equity play. And like you said, nobody knows about appreciation. So I would say it really depends on your appetite, what your goals are. And I would always do a blend. I love what you say about don't go into more than five markets, but diversify yourself in at least three. And I would say even within a market, look at that. Look at some A and B. So for me, my personal portfolio, that's what I do. I'm in A and B areas that I'm going to get a nice cash on cash return. I'm in parts of town that I'd let my, you know, my parents live in those houses. I can drive my kids to those neighborhoods. I feel good about that. Yep. But, you know, when you look at the complete return you're getting on that investment, you know, my internal rate of return, you know, depending on the situation, I mean, you can't compare it to anything else that's out there. Gold, the stock market, when you're talking about, you know, 15 to 35% true return when you're
looking overall return on investment. And of course, these are projections. They don't work out that way all the time. Sometimes they work out a lot better. So, you know, real estate, because it's an income property, I should say, it's a multidimensional asset class, and you get that return from several areas. So it's pretty phenomenal in that way.
Yeah. So that's what I would say. I would do a blend, and that's what I do, and that's what I recommend to folks. It really depends on what you're looking for. Pure cash flow, you know, long-term play, kind of what stage you're at in your investing cycle as well.
Absolutely. So that's one of the commandments. You know, thou shalt use financial planning techniques, but instead of applying it to the crappy Wall Street assets, apply it to the most historically proven asset class in world history, and that's income property. What is your time horizon? What are your investment goals? You know, what is your risk tolerance? There are many things to consider. That's why we have our investment counselors to guide you through this process. And you know what, folks? Some of our clients call and they have a consultation with our investment counselors, and they just sort of want to buy. I would encourage you to make your investment counselor, I'm telling you, you know, make them guide you through some of these questions and decisions, okay? So you'll get the properties that are best for you, and that's what we're here to do, to help you with all of that. Be sure to, if you have an Alexa, be sure to download our Alexa skill and set it up on your flash briefing, and then, hey, you can hear me every day on your Alexa flash briefing, and we got some good stuff there. We have a huge subscriber base growing on that, so the Alexa skill is in the Alexa store, I guess they call it. Set it up so that I am in your flash briefing every day, and also join us in Hawaii. First week in November, we got our two events coming up there, Profits in Paris. Paradise is filling up nicely now, I'm glad to say. At first, that was going kind of slow, but now people are really scooping up tickets, and I think that event will probably sell out, especially given how much time we have before the event. So be sure to get your tickets so you're included in that. We're planning to do a luau. We might do a sailing trip, you know, networking luau, networking sailing trip. Hawaii is just gorgeous. I haven't been there in years. I can't wait to go back. This is our first event in Hawaii. If you're listening to us from Asia, Australia, New Zealand, you know, hey, this is the closest we'll probably get to you. So come on over and see us. And we'd love to have you there in Hawaii. Go to jasonhartman.com and check out the Profits in Paradise Conference and join us for the Venture Alliance retreat. That's just one day later in Kauai. So you can group those two events together and make it an awesome time. Okay, hey, we got part two of Richard Wilson today, and let's talk about investing techniques of the ultra wealthy and family offices. So here we go. Before you leave the family office thing, do you have to have a certain amount of net worth to have a family office?
Yes. I mean, typically to become a client of a multifamily office, you know, some will take you in at seven. Many start at 10 million net worth or liquid investments. And then, you know, in the 10 to 30 million range, you're typically becoming a client of a multifamily office. Once you do get worth 25, 30 million, especially when you get worth 70, 100 million plus, you typically look at starting a single family office for yourself, even if a multifamily office or private bank,
okay,
you know, like a Goldman or UBS is helping manage part of it.
You keep saying multifamily office, and I'm not sure people know what that means. Do you mean for multiple families or multifamily properties? Just distinguish
that
if you would. Yeah.
Yeah. So it doesn't have anything to do with multifamily properties, but multifamily offices are family offices that serve five clients, 10 clients, maybe 100 different clients. Mm-hmm. There's one multifamily office I know that only takes $100 million net worth clients, mm-hmm. and they have about 30 clients. Yeah. Some others have 200 clients, all worth $10 million each. And so,
but again, when you're doing that, you're really just back to the outsourcing and the control problem, aren't you? Or maybe not, because they don't sell anything. There's never a conflict of interest, probably, right?
Yeah, most of the time they don't sell anything. Or if they do, they say our only area of expertise is self-storage. So if you ever want access to self-storage, it's an option on the table. Everything else is third party, and we're not pushing you a product. We just charge you a flat fee, and it's not, you know, we don't care which one you choose. It's just whatever's best for you. So some of them are conflicted, and they just try to wear it on the sleeve to kind of, you know, show that they do have one thing that they do internally.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Okay. Go ahead with best practices of centimillionaires.
So I think a couple of the most important points, I mean, one you kind of were hinting towards already about identifying a bottleneck. And we oftentimes refer to those, like Vern Harnish, he talks about choke points. And essentially what I found in my own business, and then I've found with many family offices, is that finding the most costly part of your business, or the thing which will be natural lead generation for your business, but it's a separate operating business in itself, can be some of the biggest sources of leverage, and they also can cost nothing. Sometimes these can be media assets. Like when we are starting the Family Office Club, we are able to acquire familyoffices.com for just $10,000, and we built it up into the most visited website on the industry. We used that to get a book deal with Wiley on family offices, and it led to our podcasts and LinkedIn groups, and it led to our events. And so each one I see as a choke point, kind of getting like a Jim Collins flywheel concept, just getting that to slowly turn over, and each choke point you can acquire turns over that flywheel another rotation and just is more forward momentum. So what's most interesting to me is that as we were growing the Family Office Club, we had a platform model that had a couple different media aspects, choke point ideas worked into it, a couple different operating businesses in one platform. And I would get critiqued sometimes of people saying, oh, you should just do one thing, or you should just focus on this one area. They didn't really understand why I had that added complexity. But what's really interesting is as I got more and more cold calls and cold reach outs from $100 million plus families, it was the centimillionaire patriarchs and the heads of the family themselves most who really loved talking about exactly what we're talking about right now. They love talking about choke points. They love talking about a platform strategy or, you know, what the idea I'm going to talk about next. And so I found that the most successful people don't approach the business in that straight head on way. They do think strategically. I've never gotten a negative ROI out of spending some really concentrated time on choke points. And I've just found that to be a very common theme within the portfolios of the clients I work with. Another strategy I want to talk about is niche domination or kind of a monopoly strategy. You know, Rockefeller was a master at basically monopolizing his area through both using choke points, but also just being able to own a high percentage of the oil trade in his time. But another example is a family I know that bought a street sweeper company that had a lot of intellectual property on it. It's the most patent device on the market. And then they were able to buy a garbage truck manufacturing company as well that also had a lot of intellectual property on it. So they could do licensing and have other ways of getting ROI on their investment. And now they have two of those high IP assets, and they're able to call on a single county, and they have both things to be selling them. And that investment has gone very well for them because their competition typically doesn't have multiple offerings, and they don't have all the intellectual property rights, which they can use to defend their turf and kind of expand how they accrue revenue in that business. So dominating a small niche area is a reoccurring theme that I've found. And it works so well that obviously there's antitrust laws that Amazon fights and that, you know, Microsoft has fought in the past and AT&T got broken apart for.
Well, and then just yesterday or a couple of days ago, that was very much in the news again with AT&T and they won the right to do that deal with Time Warner. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The reason why it's illegal on a mass level is because it works too well.
Yeah,
like
right.
It breaks the game of capitalism because you destroy your competition.
Monopolies are great.
So, yeah. You know, but in a small local market, in a small niche market, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so no one should take any action based off any podcast they listen to without talking to a lawyer. But like in certain small markets or in a small real estate geography, you know, like a 4-block area that's near downtown area that you think inevitably will be worth more in the future, or a new niche area in stem cells that, yep. You know, there's opportunities to monopolize a little niche and just nail that and be all over it. And mm-hmm. I see families doing that and having done that. And if they do it in a rising tide, like Warren Buffett says, sometimes the tide matters more than the swimmer.
Yep.
You know, if you identify that right tide and apply choke points and a niche domination strategy, I find these things in combination just lead to a real superior force in the marketplace.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. That's probably a good segue into maybe another best practice of the centimillionaires.
Another one that I found is that they like to be as close to the source of an investment as possible. So they would be the last person to want to invest in a deal or even hear about a deal where it was a broker who's part of a broker network, and then they heard there's a deal in this other location, and they're not tied to it closely. The centimillionaires that I've worked with most often are trying to get direct to the source of the deal, because as the least layers of fees, they can manage the deal directly, add their strategic expertise. And so getting direct to the deal is a best practice, but then also directly to that, defining exactly what their strike zone is for a deal and getting as much of that specific type of deal flow as possible is really key to the most informed and most successful centimillionaire investors I know. So mm-hmm. to contrast it, some people come into wealth, like the family that walked into our office 4 days ago. They're selling a business for $110 million. They have the contract in place. They're just waiting for it to close next month. And they said, well, we'd invest in just about anything. And it's kind of like graduating from college with a business degree and saying, like, I'd work in any area of business. Yeah. You know, I'm open to it all. It's like, well, you might be today, but I can tell you for sure, 7 years from now, after 4 jobs or after 14 investments, you know, like there'll be areas that you do not want to ever invest in again. Or after a few meetings, you know, you narrow it down. I try to help families go through that maturity without the pain of spreading their money out in a bunch of random things, because another way to say it is each investment you make is going to bear strategic fruits. And if you don't have a strike zone defined that's based on your DNA, what you're passionate about, what you can make a lot of money at, and if it's not highly intentional of who you're taking meetings with and what types of deals you'll consider, you know, you're not going to be having the synergies come out on the other side.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. You know, I get these calls from these hokey people all the time that are like, well, you know, I'm like the 17th person removed from a deal that I want to tell you about. I got this hot deal, and that just doesn't have a lot of credibility to me. And you shouldn't waste your time chasing those kind of deals. You know, everybody's got some deal like that, but it doesn't mean it's any good.
Right, or that it's real.
Yeah, or that it's real at all. You know, that especially happened in the REO market, real estate owned by banks, right, years ago during the Great Recessions. You'd get these people that really have no connection to the deal at all. They're just someone that knows someone that knows someone that knows someone. You know, it's like 26 steps down the line, and they're trying to, you know, market this tape of properties to you. It's just absurd. I mean, these guys are just the hokiest thing ever, you know?
Yeah. It's comically absurd. Yeah. Like, I've gotten so many of those emails in the past, and having a really well-defined strike zone is just good for everybody, because then people know what type of deal flow to send you. You can say, well, our strike zone's right on our website, so of course I'm going to say no to that pitch. And you can tell yourself that internally, tell your team, or tell the person in person at the event that you're at, or the email you get. You can just point them to that strike zone checklist. Right. And many people start out saying, oh yeah, consumer product businesses, that's our focus.
Yeah.
You know, but there's 20 niches in there. And you mean U.S. or non-U.S., control, non-control, debt, equity. You know, it's, if you don't have a dozen things on your checklist, then you are wasting a lot of energy, or you just have to realize we're on a learning curve here. And, you know, for the next 18 months, we're learning, and we shouldn't say yes, or we should be very careful.
Yeah, right. Okay. All right. What else?
I think the one that ties together a lot of these ideas, and the number one thing that I start with any client that we help form a single family office for, is that they need to have a dashboard and really a compass of where they want to go documented. So essentially, if you don't know your family's values, missions, objectives, the reality you want to create in terms of level of chaos and control and transparency, then you don't know what your direct investment strike zone should be. You don't know what your portfolio should be. You don't know if you should hire your sister or hire Goldman Sachs or hire a multifamily office or start your own. So the most important thing is to be highly intentional about exactly what you're trying to do and why. After you have that one page, and we try to fit it strictly onto a single page, then we help create the rest of a dashboard that really documents what real estate assets they have, what assets they're looking for, and what's the deal flow they're looking at. They might be considering 12 deals at a time, and if they don't have it on a dashboard, they might forget about a deal that they looked at a teaser at, where they're in a data room for two other deals, and they might have had lunch on a few other deals, and it's hard to talk about it as a cohesive team if you're not just a one-man band, you know, type family office. You know, you need to be communicating what deals are on the radar and why, and how those fit into
the big picture,
mission and values and objectives. Yeah, and so a lot of families just have that up in their head, or they might have a spreadsheet for deals they've invested in, or some $200,000 a year fancy software reporting solution that somebody sold them. But a lot of families do not have just a 4 to 7 page basic dashboard. You know, it's basically a map of where they want to go. And then the other pieces of it are kind of plotting the course in the different parts of their portfolio, including a page managing service providers and what needs to iterate next in the family office to move things forward. And so the most successful centimillionaires I know, they have to be on top of all of that. I wouldn't say a lot of them have that documented, but it's like basically it doesn't cost anything. It's not rocket science. It's just a mindset of reducing chaos and, you know, having the basics and fundamentals.
Yeah, makes sense. Makes sense. Absolutely. Okay, good. Well, just wrap it up for us. Maybe if you want to share one more principle, I know we got to get wrapping up here, but, or just any other thoughts to kind of put this in a box for us.
Sure. I think the last principle I'd like to leave with is that after 11 years of running the Family Office Club, I think that the most important thing I've found from working with clients and running our own team is integrity, and not just moral integrity, which is alignment of your values with just kind of good morals, but really integrity in terms of everything in your business, in your portfolio, on your team, how you talk, how you interact with others, your branding, the clothes you wear, where you live, products you offer, all of those things being all integrated, I think is the most important thing to be focusing on, whether you are worth $1 million or 30 million or $1 billion. That goes for within a business as well as in your personal life, because when it's not, then something is in conflict and you're just fighting yourself and you're dragging an anchor behind you. And I love this concept because I apply it to myself, my clients, our events, our company overall. And I just find that it's really helpful in making sure that the clients we engage with are also aligned with where we're going and who we can serve best. And so just keeping integrity centered and central in everything we do and encouraging our family office clients to do so as well, I think just removes a lot of stress and chaos and lost capital for people who are investing and who don't kind of stick to their principles.
Absolutely. I think that's very good advice. Richard, give out your website.
It's just simply familyoffices.com. And we've got a free book on there for family offices if anyone wants to learn the basics.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us again. It was good talking with you.
Great. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you so much for listening. Please be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss any episodes. Be sure to check out the show's specific website and our general website, hartmanmedia.com, for appropriate disclaimers and terms of service. Remember that guest opinions are their own, and if you require specific legal or tax advice or advice in any other specialized area, please consult an appropriate professional. And we also very much appreciate you reviewing the show. Please go to iTunes or Stitcher Radio or whatever platform you're using and write a review for the show. We would very much appreciate that. And be sure to make it official and subscribe so you do not miss any episodes. We look forward to seeing you on the next episode.